Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thanks for joining us. This is Bruce Norris. Today we're joined by Christopher Thornburg. He is a founding partner of Beacon Economics. Dr. Thornburg is an expert in the study of regional economies, real estate dynamics, labor markets, and business forecasting. Prior to launching Beacon, he worked with the UCLA Anderson Forecast, where he regularly authored the outlooks for California, Los Angeles, and the East Bay. Dr. Thornburg lectures on a regular basis and continues to teach in the MBA program in the New Rady School of Business at UCSD. Dr. Thornburg, welcome again.
Welcome. Good to be here.
We had an interesting conversation with a gentleman a couple hours ago before I started talking with you. There's a major builder in Riverside that has decided that they are going to just stucco the remaining houses they have in Riverside and board them up and wait for things to get better. That's going to be quite a wait.
Yes, it is. And the question is can they carry all that capital in the short run? I mean, that's, you think about those land costs, the kind of interest rates they're paying on that land. It remains to be seen whether or not they can weather this particular storm. However, Inland Empire is definitely one of the worst markets out there. I mean, you're hearing stories about having auctions and nobody's showing up. The question is there any buyers at any price willing to, you know, get into these properties at this point in time?
Well, the answer is, yeah, there is. There's a couple thousand transactions last month, but yeah, they were at a price that maybe that was a lot less than people thought they'd go for. I guess one of my points is somehow the builder is being told that's a wise decision. They must have a consultant that's saying, wait till next year, it'll be better.
Right. Very possible.
You think it is possible?
No.
Okay. possible they're being told that.
There that's telling that.
Okay.
You know, builders are by definition, as you know, the optimists of the economy. All developers are by definition some of the most optimistic people out there, for better or for worse. So, you know, in many ways, when you think that these guys were building homes, even now, you know, what degree of optimism does that show? This market peaked out at the end of 2005. Even then, you know, when that happened, beginning of 2006, I saw the numbers, I knew it was happening, I said 2 years this thing's going to come to a head. 2 years is when this thing's going to be really painful, because that's how these things go. And if you look at the late 80s, that market in the late 80s peaked out in late 1988, early 1989. The real pains didn't start to kick in until mid-1990, late 1990. That's the way these housing markets work. They have an incredibly long lag. Now, there are a lot of organizations out there, a lot of builders, who continue to build. They continue to permit for building. They continue to level land for more of these developments. They completely ignored the basic warning signs right through this. So, sure, are they capable of making a bad decision? They have been for the last couple of years. They're certainly capable of making those bad decisions today.
When you, if you're a builder and you hire a forecaster or an economist to tell you what's coming, do you really want to know what's coming, or do you really want to hear what you want to hear?
Unfortunately, the latter seems to be the rule of the day.
It sure does.
It's amazing to me how you find that people just will ignore your message. You know, I've given plenty of talks in front of groups. I've been the kind of the nutcase on the West Coast who's been dissing real estate. I'm the guy who gets up on stage, and then me, I sit down, and then I have three real estate agents sit up in front and poo-poo me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a nice theory, and certainly there's some froth out there, but overall things are fine, and there's lots of reasons for this. The entire industry sends a message. And in many ways, if you're listening, you know, when it comes to information like anything else in the U.S. economy, it's caveat emptor, right? Let the buyer beware.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's kind of the philosophy of our economy, for better or for worse. Now, unfortunately, what that means is people hear what they want to hear. And what people hear is that they want to hear that the price of their home is going up and it's going to be this high because it makes them feel good.
You know, I can understand that take for a homeowner, an individual, but a builder who has to look forward because they're going to grade dirt and put in sewers, and it takes sometimes years for all that to occur, why they wouldn't want a forecaster like yourself to say, you know what, where we are is really comfy, but where we're going is really bad. I don't understand why they wouldn't want to hear that, but you're absolutely right. They don't want to hear it.
That's easy enough. I can tell you that right now.
Okay.
CEOs in much of our economy today are paid on the basis of short-run gains. I mean, you know, let's take a financial firm. Let's take Chuck Prince, for example. I want that job. I want to get fired and get $40 million. Can someone sign me up for that job? How about O'Neill over there at the other place? He got $150 million when he left. How do I sign up for that job where I can get fired and get $150 million on the way out? How about Robert Toll? Robert Toll knew this was going to happen, but what difference? He didn't care. He was selling off his own stock for years. Mozilla was selling off his own stock for years. These guys sold everything off. They reduced their personal risk to it, and they're walking away multi-gazillion years while the little people are getting crushed. So, I mean, the incentive on Wall Street, the incentive for these corporate boards is quite simple. Make your money and walk away. Because you're walking away with millions. You're not being held personally responsible for this. You're making tons of money, and you're fine. Wow. A worst-case scenario for Toll Brothers is they go bankrupt. What does he care?
I guess I'm so naive, I thought he probably would.
I don't hope he does.
Okay.
It's not his losses.
All right, let's talk about the financial side of this. The bonds right now are telling us there's probably going to be another rate cut. And then the Federal Reserve Governor, Randall Krosner, came out and basically said, I wouldn't count on it. So what do you think is going to happen there?
Well, they're between a rock and a hard place. In oil prices up to close to $100 a barrel, is definitely putting inflationary pressure on the economy. Gas prices are up, 30, 40 cents over the last month? Now, we saw the last CPI report. The last CPI report said about a 0.3% increase from September to October, mm-hmm. which is not low, not high. It's kind of in the middle. But again, that didn't have any of this new surge in energy prices built in. That was taken mid-month before things started getting painful out there. What do you think November's number is going to look like?
Yeah,
it's going to be off the charts.
Yeah, you could be at 4 or something like that.
Exactly. And, of course, you know, it's this weird spiral. They cut rates. The dollar takes another drop, which causes the price of oil to go up yet again. So we have – they're in a very tough place right now. Greenspan had a phenomenal ability to cut rates back in the day, because of the fact that the dollar remained high, because the housing market remained strong and everything else. Bernanke, his hands are considerably more tied than Greenspan's were. In many ways, he's dealing with the problem that Greenspan made, and I feel bad for him on that count.
Yeah,
I mean, boy,
he's
you want to
designated
a job at the wrong time. This is it.
He's a designated bag holder a little
oh,
bit.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, is he looking at a much smaller version but a similar story as Volcker was, where you have the potential for stagflation in the country?
No.
Okay.
No, absolutely not, because Volcker came into power after years of excessively loose monetary policy. And as a result of that, he came in and really had to change monetary policy. And he did so dramatically. He did so sharply. Really, in many ways, a lot of people say he was the cause, he was the engineer of that deep, deep 1983 recession. You know, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. What I do know is I think the most central bankers in the world have learned the long-run follies of using inflationary policy to try to bail the economy out of trouble. To some extent, the economy has to take its lumps. It has to return to a more balanced basis. That means the financial markets have to get these losses out of their system. That means the consumer has to cut their spending down to something that's more in line with their income. That means you have to see that trade deficit continue to disappear. Now, the only thing the Fed can do in the context of that is try to make that pain as less as possible. And there's no point in trying to minimize pain today that's going to cause more pain down the road. First and foremost, they're going to be interested in price stability. On the second level, on the second count, they have to start worrying about economic stability. So, you know, given those choices, yeah, I do believe that they may not be cutting. I think a lot of it's going to depend on this next inflation report. The good news is as consumer spending starts to slow, what you'll have on the back end, of course, is some reduction in inflationary pressures because there's not going to be so much demand out there, so more aggregate demand. And that may help a little bit, but I think you're going to have to see the next inflation report before they can make any decision on that.
Okay, if the Fed sees a recession ahead, is there any inflationary worries that would be so great that they wouldn't be able to cut interest rates, let's say, next year?
Wow. No, probably not. You know, it's the hardest thing in the world to predict, of course, is inflation. It's very, very hard to see. Never easy at the best of times. And so from that perspective, you're just going to have to let the data speak for itself, see what those numbers come in at. I don't think that there's enough inflationary pressures inside the U.S. economy that will create such a bad situation that will cause that. If we had a lot of liquidity out there, perhaps. But if you look at the basic monetary aggregates, you compare them to the income overall, they're not that high. And so, to a certain extent, price increases in, say, the real sector could be offset by price decreases elsewhere, which, again, yet again, will be stimulated by decreases in overall economic demand in our economy. So my guess is they're actually going to wait to see a real reduction in consumer spending. And then at that point in time, they'll have the leverage, the leeway in order to cut rates.
Okay, let's talk about consumer spending. Been very resilient. I'd like to know how we're keeping it going, or are we about not to? Okay, so what are we accessing that's spendable at this point?
Well, up to August, of course, there was quite a bit of money still in those mortgage markets.
Correct.
Sure, the subprime shut down, but there were still second mortgages going on out there. People still had a lot of equity in their home. They still felt safe. Well, now people don't feel safe anymore. Interest rates, of course, are up. The second mortgage market is way declined. People have, to some extent, been using other forms of debt. You've seen a big spike, for example, in personal loans. It's amazing to me. Some of these banks, particularly smaller banks, have been putting out a lot of money in terms of an unsecured personal loan. Not a good situation, certainly not something you want to see in this point in the cycle. Credit card debt is also going up quite a bit. You're seeing revolving debt also start to increase. So people are accessing different forms of leverage to continue to borrow.
Mm-hmm.
But I think all the numbers are pretty clear. There's definitely weakness in the market. And again, it's only going to get worse. All those foreclosures are just now starting to kick in. It's going to make it a very gloomy Christmas season for many people.
I read something where the foreclosures or subprime adjusting, having their first payment adjustment, is going to happen sometime in 2008. I think you know specifically what the month is?
In terms of the peak?
Yeah.
Well, I think the overall peak in the resets actually occurs in the third quarter of 2008.
Okay.
But, of course, that would include prime as well as subprime.
Okay. Third quarter of 2008, one of the things that I just read over the weekend is DataQuick said it's taking lenders median 5 months to begin the process. So if you're in the third quarter of 2008, they will not possibly be able to get to the marketplace as an REO for the 5 months plus 4 months foreclosure process, probably not till about 10 months after that peak. So you're looking way into 2009 before the glut of foreclosures starts declining.
Oh, yeah. I go farther than that. Remember that the peak of foreclosures in the last cycle occurred actually in 1994. And that was years after. So in a sense, oh, yeah. I mean, you're going to have continued problems for years. Of course, yet again, we're entering into an election year. There's going to be policy changes on this count. Things are going to change. They're just not going to let this occur. Now, I don't know exactly what they're going to do. That's one of the most difficult forecasts in the world to make. But you could bet your bottom dollar that they're going to do something. Because they can't sit in the sideline and allow 2 million people to get foreclosed on. They won't do that. And so you're going to have some sort of reaction and policy on the part of the government. What that will be eventually, I just don't know. You know, it's interesting. You want to talk about political battles 101. The fight over policy changes here is one of the most direct policy battles you can have. This is pure populism versus pure cash.
Okay.
On this corner, the millions of people, mom and pops, getting foreclosed on their homes on the basis of those evil mortgage companies.
Mm-hmm.
On this side, billions of dollars in bank cash. and in the middle there, in that middle of that firestorm, it's going to be generated some degree of policy on how to deal with this. And wow, is that going to be an interesting battle to watch play out. Again, understand that if you move all these homes under bankruptcy protection retroactively, you are going to increase the foreclosure rate by X amount. Or, I mean, sorry, not increase, but you increase the bankruptcy rate by X amount. because everybody who doesn't have any secondary assets is immediately going to go to bankruptcy court to seek protection.
Correct.
And if you have that happen, take these bad losses on Wall Street, and you can multiply them by three.
Okay. Oh, my. All right, well, let's compare the 2001 stock hit to a decline in real estate equity. Which one is more detrimental to consumer spending?
Oh, definitely the housing market is. Not to say that stock markets don't swing as much in the context of overall wealth. The difference is the impact of changes in wealth on overall consumer spending. You know, even a kind of a cursory estimate shows that the impact of changes in the real estate markets, changes in equity wealth in real estate markets, to have an impact four or five or six times that of changes in equity wealth in the stock market. The reason for that, of course, is numerous. A lot of stocks are wrapped up in things like 401k programs, which are not very tradable. People don't react immediately on that. You can't borrow very easily against those holdings the way you can your house. There's different tax implications of cashing out for these two different products. You know, you can sell your house and not pay income taxes. Sell your stock portfolio. You capitalize that out. You take a tax hit on that. And, of course, overall, stock equity is held in a much more concentrated pocket in the economy than housing wealth is. Housing wealth is spread out much more egalitarian across the population. There's lots of reasons why the stock market just doesn't have the same degree of impact.
Okay. If we've relied a lot on credit lines, equity lines, to kind of as a second job, it's about time, at least in California, that they reappraise the properties that those credit lines are on. Moreno Valley, we follow that market very carefully. In a 12-month period, you have a 30% price decline that's really real.
Wow.
And so if you had a credit line at 80%, you now have a credit line at 110%.
Right.
The bank really has a responsibility to come in and reappraise that property and lower that line. Don't you think that somebody behind them is going to say, you guys have to go do that?
You'd think so. Well, you know, and don't forget, on top of everything else, on that same note, think about property taxes.
Sure, the decline.
why is Schwarzenegger coming out and raising the alarm? Well, I'll tell you why. They're seeing firsthand that this thing's about to unwind.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay, so he orders a 10% budget cut. That has to affect jobs in California, does it not?
Well, absolutely it does. Now, of course, what that implies is the government suddenly becomes a source of more cyclical uncertainty rather than a force for stable cyclical stabilization. You know, when you look back on time, and you talked about good old Keynes and his prescribed use of fiscal and monetary policy in order to smooth the business cycle. One of the things he said was that government should be spending more in times of downturn and less in times of good. We of course have lovely term limits in California, which means that you think CEOs have short timer's disease. Wow, everybody in Sacramento has even worse short timer's disease. And so we have cyclical spending in Sacramento, not counter-cyclical spending. As soon as they get the money, they spend every bit of it plus 5%, because that's their incentive. It lands them, and as long as they can feed their constituencies, it lands them with a nice cushy job when they get booted out of office. And so on top of everything else that's going to happen, you're going to have this major meltdown in our state fiscal situation.
Now, we've had some pretty good boom years in California. Are you telling me we haven't saved anything up?
I think you know the answer to that as well as I do. Of course, we have never fixed the problems that occurred in the late 90s. Again, you got to look at history, historically speaking, for this. It's been a fun, I got into this market about 2000. I started doing this stuff, first for UCLA and now on my own. So I've been studying everything for a very interesting 7 years, to say the least.
That has been a great 7 years to do it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you talk about lots of lessons being learned. Well, you know, you go back in time, ask where the state is today, well, you can thank Gray Davis and the people who work with him in Sacramento, who, for the most part, have disappeared to the various corners of the state and various corners of the business, yet again, because of term limits. Most of these people are gone and off doing different things. But yet again, you can lay these problems right at their feet, because in the late 90s, you saw a massive increase of revenues that was clearly temporary. We saw a permanent increase in expenditures. Schwarzenegger came in promising to fix it. He didn't fix it. He just kind of tried to paper it over. they were in many ways bailed out from having to make tough decisions on the basis of the real estate boom. Well, the bailout has just ended, and of course, now we're finally going to have to deal with the situation that occurred in the late 90s.
When a state is in that situation, how do they borrow money, and is their credit status affected by, you know?
Oh, absolutely, their credit status is affected. Now, you're going to see downgradings in state bonds and municipal bonds across California. Absolutely, there's going to be a big mess in that front. Cost of capital borrowing will be very, very high because a lot of groups are going to wonder if the state has the ability to repay it. I mean, we already have massive amounts of obligations as a result of the borrowing that Schwarzenegger's already done, both for fixing our roads as well as to get over the budget gap that he inherited from Gray Davis, as opposed, again, to dealing with the problem by recognizing that we're a state that either has to cut spending or increase taxes, period. They rather try to borrow their way out of having to make any tough decisions. So, you know, a lot of gimmickry, just basic
bait and switch.
Well, bait and switch, and just in many ways, just not acknowledging the obvious.
Yes. Job situation over the 2007, 109,000 jobs added last month in October, lost 15,800. Is that likely to be the new trend? Is that we lose jobs?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. You got to be a little cautious about that number. We saw from August to September, we saw magically 10,000 jobs appear in the motion picture industry, and then from September to October, they disappeared. That's a statistical fluke. So you remove that from it, and we had far fewer jobs the month before, and we didn't lose as many the month after. So okay. Be cautious of those numbers because of that. But overall, clearly, weakening overall in job growth, not a big surprise. For me, the most worrisome number is unemployment. Unemployment up nearly a full percentage point since the start of the year, and that says it all. Because unemployment, when that starts to rise, it doesn't just stop. When you see unemployment go up by a percentage point, it thereby goes up another 2 percentage points, typically.
It's
so
being caused
unless
by
magical happens this time,
mm-hmm.
strengthen this economy. I don't know what that magic may be, but unless something magical happens, it's very easy to predict that, look, it's going up by this much, it's going to go up by that much more.
Usually unemployment leads to migration loss. People go find jobs maybe elsewhere. Do you see that coming as well?
Well, out migration from the state, you mean? Yeah, well, people have already believed in the state in droves, but in this case, because of high housing prices, which
correct.
Is very unusual. Will people leave California? Well, it depends on how well the rest of the United States weathers this. I mean, it's not unemployment, it's relative unemployment.
Okay.
So, yes, absolutely. In the short run, you're seeing unemployment rise in California relative to other places. The question is if other parts of the United States actually weather the storm and continue to thrive, yes, you'll see more people leave. But you have to look at California's unemployment rate relative to the rest of the United States.
All right. We've got a couple more minutes. Commercial real estate.
Mm.
Do you view that as following the path of residential at some point?
Yeah, absolutely. Two reasons. I mean, cap rates are shockingly low, as if there's no more risk in commercial. There is risk in commercial. Yet again, it's a slower cycle in many ways. You have to take retail, for example. If you bought retail in San Jose in 2000, I mean, to some extent you knew that the market was overheated, but nonetheless, you saw 2% vacancy rates. You saw rental rates increasing by double-digit levels over the last couple years. Information technology is booming. The world is wonderful. If you bought retail, you got a cap rate that was about 4% over the 10-year treasury. Today, when you have 11% vacancy, where rents are rising at 3 or 4% per year, and you bought some retail space, you would get a cap rate that's about 2% over the 10-year treasury, or 1% over the 10-year treasury.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to ask yourself, how out of whack is this market where, when you look at the San Jose retail market today, those cap rates are so much lower than they were in 2000 when the world was wonderful.
Well, when you have a rising cap rate, obviously you have a depreciation of that asset, and they're going to have a lot of REOs in that category as well.
Exactly.
Christopher, we are done with our time. Thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk with us. As always, it's been very educational.
My pleasure.
All right, thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week here on News Talk 590 KTIE.